Howdy, everybody, and welcome to another BP Movie Journal, the show we do where we talk about the stuff we've seen since the last time we did one of these. I'm David.
I'm Tyler.
And as seems to have become our schedule, it's been 2 weeks. It'll be 2 weeks, I think, until our next one.
It's yeah.
Not on purpose. We want to do movie journals every week, but things are very busy. Yeah,
it's a busy time.
And also, I'm getting back on track, but I'm still just not watching as many movies. Partially because I'm on vacation right now, which is weird.
You're on vacation right now?
I'm on vacation right now.
Oh, wow.
This is the first, I took 2 weeks off from work, and it's the first time that I've used any vacation time since before the pandemic.
Do you consider yourself a workaholic, David?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right.
Do you think of me as a workaholic?
No, I don't. Okay. But it's just something, I don't think of myself as a workaholic, but then I look at patterns and thought processes from the last several years, and I'm like, oh.
Huh. Well, I think I don't. In Natalie's words, or Natalie's way of thinking, I do not exercise good work-life balance.
Sure.
Like, I say that I've been on vacation, like, taking 2 weeks. I've been checking my email every day and replying to work emails when I feel like I need to. Because there are people covering for me. So if there's a question, if I see an email come through that I could answer right away, but I'm like, the people covering for me, they'll know that. I'll step back.
Yeah.
But if it's like, oh, this is going to cause the people who are covering for me more work to research, whereas I could answer this off the top of my head, I will send an email and I feel more at ease about that. I don't know, but I don't think that's the same as being a workaholic, because I don't define,
right.
I don't define my life by
It's a boundary. It's a boundaries issue,
but it,
in some,
but
ways.
It also like it works for me. I don't know. This sounds like me like saying I'm a gambling addict who has a system or whatever, but it works for me. I have found that if I try to go a whole weekend just stepping away from my work email, it causes me more anxiety than if I just check in every once in a while, because I will catastrophize. I will, if I don't check my email for 12 hours, I will think something terrible has happened. Some fuck up I made has come to light and everyone is mad at me. And it's easier on my brain if I check my email regularly.
If I don't necessarily get work email often, but if I'm being honest, if a student emails me, it's not super urgent. But if my boss emails me, I feel like I don't necessarily assume that I've done something wrong, but I also don't not assume it.
Yeah.
And I feel like I need to know what the issue is, if there's an issue, and there's like, oh, they're just updating about a screening or something like that. But like,
right.
It's like, I need to know if there's an issue and if, and even if it's not urgent, it's like, well, if I respond now, I've done my part, and it's done. It's over. As opposed to like, oh, I'm not going to get to it for 2 hours. That's 2 hours of worry.
Yeah.
And that's 2 hours of a thing. Even if I know that it's something that requires a response, but it's not a problem, then it's just a thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a good chance I'll forget in 2 hours. As you know, I'm not great at responding to, if I don't respond immediately, there's an 85% chance I'm never responding.
I also, in my work, I have implemented a task that I use when I'm emailing you with a certain vendor that we work with.
Oh, okay.
I have come to the realization I cannot ask two different questions or ask for two different things to be done in the same email. They have to be separate emails, and I got that from you. It's one thing per email, Tyler.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, so I haven't taken a vacation since I went to Vegas in February of 2020. And I was supposed to last September of 2020, Natalie and I were supposed to go to Buenos Aires.
That's right.
We obviously had to cancel that because of COVID, but the airline made us reschedule like within a year. So we had it scheduled for this September, still can't go to Argentina because of COVID, unfortunately. But we set it to like,
were you able to reschedule or did that
time,
just go away?
I think
away?
This came up on the podcast before. This time they finally let us just get a refund.
Okay.
Which was, because I think we talked about this before on the podcast. But anyway, but we decided not to like cancel our vacation days, to just take a vacation because other things are open, like, and available to vaccinated people in certain parts of the country. So we decided to, instead of doing a 2-week trip to Buenos Aires, we're doing 3 mini trips. So we went to Seattle for a few days, came back, went to Solvang, wine country, for our anniversary. Just got back from that yesterday. We're home for a couple days, and then we're going to Joshua Tree to celebrate my birthday.
All right.
Out in Joshua Tree. So, yeah, places.
The big 3-4. No. I'm trying to help you here.
Yeah, no. No, I'm about to be 39, and as my mother-in-law says, every time I tell her about to be 39, she says, and holding, right? I love my mother-in-law. She's a delight. So yeah, that's part of the reason that it's been 2 weeks since we've done one of these. I've only watched 3 movies. So that's part of the, half of the time I've been, out of town. I've been on a plane twice since being vaccinated. I guess 4 times, because, right. 6 times if you count layovers. Anyway, that's not the point. I've taken 2 plane trips, I guess. Mm-hmm. Again, more than that. I don't know how you say that. Two
round trips?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, round trip plane trips. And I've realized that, my life, because Natalie and I are so, during the pandemic, so generally very observant and cautious, even though we've all been wearing masks forever, I realized I never had a mask on for more than 45 minutes at a stretch. Either, early COVID when we were doing, if I was walking the dog around the neighborhood, I'd wear a mask. Now it's if I'm running into the grocery store or whatever, I didn't wear a mask for it didn't even occur to me. But it was oh yeah, that's the longest. But now we were occasionally going to movies, and then a plane, especially if you have a layover, you're wearing a mask for 6, 7, 8 hours at a time. I am lucky to be a bearded gentleman because my mask knee is so fucking bad. I have so many I don't know if you've had that mask knee problem.
No,
but it's been a real problem for me. That's the downside of vacation during COVID.
The biggest issue for me is just glasses fogging up. It's infuriating.
I feel it's so weird we're talking about masks a year and a half after, but we're still talking about it. But I found after everything, I know that they're bad for the environment, but the disposable medical masks, they work better than any other cloth mask.
They do.
That's
the ones that's what I wear these days.
Because they're the best at preventing the fogging. I've found, I don't know, I wish I could find a good reusable mask that has all of the same dimensions and the little bar that you squeeze over your nose. That's what I want.
I switched to
what I really want is have to wear masks anymore.
I switched to the disposable ones once school started and it was in session, because I had to lecture. And I found with cloth masks or whatever you call it, they're comfortable in other ways, but to talk, your jaw's constantly moving and it's just, and it wiggles around a little bit and you have to readjust it. Whereas I do feel disposable surgical mask. I don't think they're surgical masks, but whatever you call them. They seem to also be a bit more flexible. So it can cling to my jaw while I'm talking for an hour.
Right. And not pull it off your nose. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we've talked about masks in
September
in 2021. Yeah. What did you watch over the past 2 weeks?
So, one film there's a review at battleshippretension.com. It is, and I'm not sure if I'm going to say this name right, John Polano's Small Engine Repair.
Okay.
Which I liked, occasionally really liked, didn't love. There are sequences and moments. It's based on a play, and that really comes through in certain moments. That's not an automatic strike against it, but it can be. And every once in a while, it feels like they're playing to the back row, and it feels like everything is just so big that it's just all right. And it also feels, from a composition standpoint, it feels like everyone's cheating out. It's you can just move the camera if you want, right? You can have them facing each other. It's fine. It deserves to be mentioned in the same breath as other movies, some of which are based on plays and some are not, but movies like Glengarry Glen Ross, or frankly, probably more American Buffalo, if you want to stick with Mamet, 25th Hour, movies very much about masculinity and friendship and that sort of thing. and there's a, and it's, you know, these three like working class guys in the Northeast and just trying to sort of, their type of masculinity is probably what could be considered toxic, the way that they, the way they are friends, just like constant, like busting balls. And just, you watch it and you're like, why are you guys hanging out? You guys don't seem to like each other, but I also know that you do, if only you were able to express this. But it, what's the, I think the most fascinating thing to me, and this is something I didn't put in my review because it's only occurred to me since then, they, all three of these guys, despite being a little older, they're kind of in a state of transition where they're starting to absorb slightly newer ideas about masculinity. And so, and that makes it so much, it makes it so much more interesting than just a pure, like, just testosterone type of thing, you know? And so, like, there's a moment where John Bernthal is in it, and he's an actor that I don't often like, because I think he's a little bit too big, but in the right character, he can work really well. But there is a scene with him and Shea Whigham, who, of course, is the MVP of the whole thing, as is not surprising.
Both Wolf of Wall Street vets.
That's true. I forgot about that.
Shea Whigham's, like, kind of barely in it. He's, like, the yacht captain,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's, yeah.
It's, like, two scenes.
He just pops up, yeah. And you know what? You know what? That's... it's the best scene in the film, Wolf of Wall Street. But yeah, so like they're these two guys, and then John Polano, the director, he plays the, basically the lead. So there's these three friends, and like they go out to a bar, and eventually, and like Shea Whigham is trying to be John Bernthal's like wingman, like with these girls. But instead, like they, and they're telling like funny stories about each other. And you know, it's like, it's only a matter of time before somebody tells the wrong kind of funny story, and then the others going to start getting angry, and oh, there it goes. And John Bernthal slaps Shea Whigham, and it's just like, it's really jarring. And immediately after, he like pulls him aside. He goes, "Hey man, you know, I'm really sorry about that." He goes, and Shea Whigham like looks like he's about to cry and goes, "That was totally wrong of me." Like, and you feel like 10 years ago, that wouldn't have happened.
Right.
But other guys in the bar see that happening, so of course they just start calling them gay and all that sort of thing, and then the fight breaks out with strangers. And so it's just, that to me is maybe the most interesting thing, is seeing this masculinity in transition. The film goes some weird places, and I don't think it always does so in a smooth way. I don't know when John Polano wrote this play. I don't know if it was his first play. It often feels like that, but there are enough moments in the film to recommend. You just need to be ready that, like, this is, you're dealing with characters that you're probably not going to like very much, but the performances are still there, and some of the concepts are really effective.
You were saying about the just waiting for the wrong story to be told.
Yeah.
Reminds me, okay, first off, we should do an episode on great scenes in bad movies.
Sure. I feel like we may have done that already.
We've just done nearly like 760 episodes. It's been, yeah. But there's a, did you ever see Guess Who? The remake of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
No,
with Ashton Kutcher and Zoe Saldana and Bernie Mac. But there's a scene where Ashton Kutcher, because it's like the race reversed, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. There's a scene where Ashton Kutcher is at like dinner with Zoe Saldana's like extended family.
Yeah.
And they're like going, they're like, "Come on, you must have heard some black jokes from your friends in like in your time." And so they're like, "Tell us some of the jokes you've heard." And so like it's the most uncomfortable because he tells a few jokes and like the characters are like, "Ah, that's a good one," or whatever. But you're just waiting the entire scene for like, he's going to go too far. Yeah. He's going to tell the wrong joke. It's such a great scene in an otherwise completely forgettable movie.
And of course, Bernie Mac, dearly missed, but he was always so good at like having that kind of humorous intensity times. But okay. So what did you watch?
So I watched the, I have come to the films of Alejandro Jodorowsky in the most backwards, out of order way. Okay. The first one I ever saw was Santa Sangre.
I don't think I've seen any of his films, actually.
So I saw Santa Sangre years ago, and then I saw, during the pandemic, I watched this newish documentary, Psycho Magic, which is terrible, by the way. which means so the two that he's best known for are El Topo and Holy Mountain. Still haven't seen those. Now I went all the way back to the beginning and saw his first film, 1968's Fando y Lis, or Fando and Lis, which is kind of like a lot of his films. Well, I think, okay, from what I understand from reading about Fando y Lis is that it got a lot of comparisons, rightfully so, to Fellini at the time, because he's very much into these, like, presenting these sort of big, almost kind of like dreamlike, circus-like tableau, you know? And I think there were, a lot of like, oh, this is lesser Fellini. So I feel by then, I'll have to watch El Topo and Holy Mountain to see how much of this is a gradual progression or how much it feels to me like an immediate one, because the next film chronologically that I've seen is Santa Sangre, which is still Fellini-esque, but very much has his, like, Jodorowsky be like, no, I'm going to be like the darkly gothic, like bloody horror adjacent Fellini.
Okay.
And Fando y Lis isn't that yet. It's about a young couple. The woman is paraplegic and needs to be like carted around. She's like in a wheelbarrow or whatever. And it's based on like a sort of a play from the time that's like an experimental, like non-narrative play. So it's basically about two young people who are trying to find this mystical land where they'll find enlightenment or whatever. And they're just traversing the mountains and they keep coming across different weird groupings of people. Like there's a group of old ladies playing bridge or cards or something like that on the edge of a cliff. And next to them is like a husky guy in his underwear to whom the ladies take turns very sensually feeding hard-boiled eggs. That's one of them. And then, like, there's another one where it's like the bomb, it looks like a bomb went off or something. There's all this rubble, but there's like people having a cocktail party, like they're in full cocktail dress and someone's playing a piano like while it's on fire. And it's just like they keep coming across these different, it's like, it's a fun like way to spend 95 minutes. Sure. You know, there's plenty of fun stuff to look at. I think as like a hippie movie, you know, I think you were talking about how circumstances and attitudes and dialogues and positions have changed with regards to certain things. I think like one thing that's come to the fore in more recent years is the idea that like, oh yeah, the hippie free love thing was still like really like masculine centered, really, sure, really like patriarchal. And I think this is not a movie that comments on it. I think it's a movie that like kind of puts it into stark relief. Like the way that Fando like treats Lis is like, it's awful at times. And I don't know how, I wonder how it was, how people saw that treatment at the time. If it was just like, oh, they're too free spirits. Like, this guy's a jerk. I look forward to, I will watch El Topo and Holy Mountain to see like the two movies that he's actually best known for, which I inadvertently saved for last. I didn't mean to, but I saved them for last. I will watch them and I'll report back on how quickly he changed, because I really like
Santa Sangre. Give yourself a birthday present, David, watch them both in one day.
There we go. But I really like Santa Sangre. But I know that's not that's second tier, I think, to Jodorowsky fans after El Topo and Holy Mountain.
All right, pivoting very much away from that type of film, I saw Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, the latest Marvel film by Destin Daniel. I don't know if it's Cretton or Cretton.
I would say Cretton.
Probably not Cretton.
Maybe it's Cretton.
Possibly. Yeah. You know what? Let's say that's what it is. It's fine. It's okay. There are moments that are great from a fighting standpoint. Like there's the first action sequence takes place like on a bus. And I think I'm a sucker for like a confined action sequence.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Whether it be like the elevator in Winter Soldier or whatever. So it's, and there's some really beautiful visuals. There is a lot of good in the film. And I do think from the perspective of like representation, I feel like it really does. It feels a lot like, Black Panther or something like that, where you realize like, oh, the vast majority of the characters are Asian American or just Asian, because you get somebody like a Tony Leung in there. Is it Leung or Leung? I never know.
Leung? It might be like okay. Two syllables. Sure. I don't know if that's right. But yeah. I don't know.
But yeah, and I do find myself thinking, like, you know, if I were a young, like, Asian American, you know, a little kid who likes the Marvel movies, and then you see this film and you're like, oh, hey, this is very exciting. The problem, as tends to happen with, in my opinion, movies like Captain Marvel and Black Panther, is that the lead is the least interesting character in the bunch. And that's nothing against Brie Larson. It's nothing against Chadwick Boseman. I think that there's such a focus on the ensemble, and the ensemble is so good that they see, like, there are times where Shang-Chi will show up, and the actor does a fine job and they write him well enough, but he shows up and I'm like, oh yeah. And I feel like you're not supposed to say, oh yeah, in the movie named after the character.
Yeah.
And that is unfortunate. I do think that the main draw from a character standpoint is Tony Leung, whatever. Because it's a really great performance and a very subtle one. And when people talk about Marvel villains, I feel like he definitely will be in the top tier. It's a really solid, performance and just a good characterization all around. There are some things that I guess at this point it's not really a spoiler because the movie's been out for a while, but like how it connects with other with the Marvel universe, like who shows up, characters you really don't expect, because just like, yeah, the first, like, not the first, not the Ang Lee Hulk, but was it Louis Leterrier?
Yeah.
Yeah, like the Abomination shows up.
I never saw that movie, so I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. People don't feel the need to watch that one, but the Abomination, who is the one of the primary villains in that film, played by Tim Roth, he's in this for like 2 seconds and apparently is played by Tim Roth. And just like, huh, all right, well, good for them trying to incorporate, you know, the sort of the misfits of the,
yeah,
of the thing. But did you see Iron Man 3?
No.
Okay. Because that's the
one. I didn't even see Iron Man 2.
I think you'd like them both. I think you would have a great deal of respect for 3 for the exact same reason I do, and for the same reason that so many people don't.
Okay.
And that's because it's Shane Black and he's doing some really interesting things, especially with the character of the Mandarin. And so they incorporate that into this, and I think they do it really well. And so it's more than a cameo. It's a genuine supporting performance. Ben Kingsley shows up.
Right.
And there's a moment where they're driving along and they stop and they're kind of in this fantasy world. And so, like, there's these very strange looking horses that pass by, and Ben Kingsley goes, "What's he looking at me for?" Which is a line from Sexy Beast, by the way, when he and Ray Winstone are in a car and a bunch of goats go by and Don Logan says, "What's he looking at me for?" And I laughed in the theater.
Yeah.
It was a pretty full theater, and I was the only one that laughed.
I wouldn't have got it, but that's awesome.
I felt both superior and inferior at the same time. And good for them for incorporating that. I love
how game Ben Kingsley is. Because I think about him as himself on The Sopranos and how funny. Fuck. And it's so funny on that show.
And for that reason, for a few reasons, but I really think you would enjoy Iron Man 3, because the whole point is that his character, like when he's playing the Mandarin, it's great. It's like really chilling and it's a really good characterization. And then when he plays Trevor Slattery, it's even more delightful. But yeah, so spoilers, I guess, everyone, sorry about that, for Iron Man 3, as well as Shang-Chi, this character shows up, but it's a fun reveal, but it's kind of common knowledge at this point.
Okay.
The film is good, not great. I don't feel like I'm going to return to it, but I'm interested to see how it plays into the larger universe.
Well, that's too bad. I was looking forward to liking a Destin Daniel Cretton film. Cretton.
You might like it more than I do. Again, I think...
But that's the thing. You talked about, like, the fight sequences. Is he, like, what in Short Term 12 or Just Mercy...
Sure.
you know, because there was
neither of which I've seen, by the way.
Who was the director? The Argentinian director, Lucrecia Martel, like mm-hmm. talked about how Marvel approached her about making one of their movies, and basically said, like, Marvel told her, like, don't worry about the action. We'll do that for you. And yes. that's like, that bothers me.
That absolutely, that comes through more, even more in Black Widow, where like you, it looks like there's two different movies happening. It's here. So, they integrated a little bit better, but I have no doubt that like the stunt coordinator and the choreographer like played just as big a role, if not bigger, than the actual director.
But I think it's even before that. There's like a pre-visualization director who's like sure. just mapping out the action sequences sure. before a single like frame of digital film has been shot. That's why like I haven't seen The Incredible Hulk, but like Louis Leterrier makes sense for an action movie. Yes. He's an action director. That
yeah.
Anyway,
and even somebody like a Kenneth Branagh for the first Thor makes a certain kind of sense.
Yeah, he did. But now it just seems like they're like picking up. Just yeah. they're trying to get cred by sweeping up like name like lauded indie directors. Well, we talked about it in the Fall Movie Preview, like how Bassam Tariq, is that his name, seems to be very likely going to be the Blade director, and it's. And like, I'd rather get another Mogul movie.
And Chloe Zhao, like I saw a trailer for Eternals, and she's directing that. And while it definitely does seem to have a more striking visual sense than other Marvel films, and I think of her and mm-hmm. Nomadland is a particularly visually gorgeous film. But at the same time, yeah, it's like on one hand, good for her. This might open some doors. I also think that Oscar for Best Director probably was going to open some doors too, but. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely getting to that point where even when it's a Marvel movie I like, I just feel like it's a shame because they're only, at best, a really distinct director is going to be able to bring maybe like 35 to 40% of themselves to that film.
All right, let's move on to a movie. It's normally the kind of movie that I don't talk much about on here because it's we've talked about like human interest documentaries, mm-hmm. the kind of documentary that I've lost some patience with, not as much as the biographical documentary, which at this point I'm just like, I've been fooled too many times, especially right. with like, cause you know, like Todd Haynes has a Velvet Underground documentary coming out and it's like, but like also Jim Jarmusch made a Stooges movie.
Yeah.
And Edgar Wright made a Sparks movie and they were both just like run of the mill rock docs. And yeah. so like, I'm not getting fooled again with the Todd Haynes movie anyway, but this isn't a biographical documentary. This is a human interest documentary. It's called Denial, or I guess its full title at one point was Denial, the Dad Who Tried to Save the World. And it's basically the filmmaker's father is a CEO for an energy company in, I'm already forgetting, Vermont, I think, who's trying to like push for like this change in how we think about energy in terms of like with climate change coming and moving towards renewables and stuff like that. And then about 25, 30 minutes into the movie, his dad comes out as transgender. it's a huge twist. And also I'm also movie savvy enough that I'm like, this happened before they started filming. And I think he intentionally waited until half an hour into the movie to make it seem like a sudden new thing. But I don't like being manipulated like that, but it does actually serve a point because the movie then starts to track these two things at once. This, I guess woman's, it's weird. Like, cause he still calls him dad.
That was my question.
But they say and the film, like the film starts referring to her as she after, sure. after that come up, but you still hear like family members saying he, and that actually is part of the movie's overall point is it's looking at climate change and this woman's transition and saying like, it's taking the way that the family is having a hard time adjusting and sort of extrapolating that to the way the world is going to have to adjust, like, climate change is happening and we're going to have to change
right.
the way we do things. And it's going to take a long time because people are resistant. Yeah. And actually you're seeing that play out in miniature in this family who are like, supportive, but also like making it about themselves at certain points. And I like sure. the director is not, too vain to show himself being kind of petulant in his reactions
yeah.
and child and sort of regressing to childhood in certain ways. It's an interesting tech that it takes. It feels very, it feels like it's made for a TV or made for like a streaming, or I think it did play theatrically. I can't remember where, festivals, but it's on Canopy for, free. If you have Canopy through your library,
Canopy is such a great service.
I love it. Yeah. That's how I saw it. No, it was actually kind of a weird thing. Cause I had heard it had been like on my radar as a climate change documentary, which are things that I tend to like, almost case in point, things that I'm like, I should probably watch that, but I don't want to, cause it's going to like scare me and upset me. Mm. But it was like under, but then I was on Canopy and it came up under like the LGBTQ banner. And I was like, right. What the fuck? Cause I didn't know this about the movie. I just knew it as, being a climate change movie. Pretty interesting, stuff. And
it sounds like a little bit more than your average human interest documentary.
Yeah. Yeah. It has a really interesting tack. And also, yeah, the, because this person's dad is the CEO of her company and actually is the first out transgender American CEO of any company. So that's interesting.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What else did you watch?
So we're getting into my next two movies are rewatches, but it has been a while. So in my diversity in cinema class this last week, we talked about depictions of Irish, comma, Italians, right, and Jews, which is to say like groups that are now grouped together with white.
Right.
But for a while, for a long while, we're really not. Our old classmate Zach Baliba is making a documentary about treatment of Italians.
I haven't. I wonder how Zach's doing. I guess you could tell me off mic.
Yeah, he's here now. Like, I think he lives in Ventura or something like that. But okay. If I weren't so damn busy with everything, I would say, hey, let's get some coffee. But anyway, and so I wasn't sure what movie I was going to show. I was curious. On the syllabus was The Quiet Man, because it's just like, well, I've never seen it, and it's an opportunity to see a movie that I haven't seen. But the more I thought of it, it's like, no, I think I want to explore like specifically the sort of an aspect of the Jewish experience on film. So I was going to do The Pawnbroker, which I love, starring Rod Steiger. But eventually I landed on David Mamet's Homicide, partially because I knew that one, maybe more than any other film I could pick, could really, frankly, frustrate the class.
That's a great, I like that impulse. It's not the, it's definitely going to push some buttons.
Yeah.
I think it's a great movie, but also I understand why someone might bristle at it as well.
Yeah, for a few reasons. One is it's Mamet speak. And somebody certainly had a problem with that. Somebody said, like, why are they talking like that? They didn't say it during the movie, thankfully. But afterwards, they're like, everything seems so robotic. I'm like, yeah, I get it. I totally get what you're saying. But it is such a, man, what a, and I haven't seen it in a while. This is probably my third time watching it. I adore it. I think it's such a, what a wonderful exploration of what you're born into, what you choose to be, and the fact that the two sometimes are in opposition, sometimes they're not. And whether they are or not is really just a function of your ability to balance that. And so you have Joe Mantegna in what could seem like a really straightforward role, but this idea that he literally has two cases, one very much his priority as a cop and the other an unexpected priority as a Jew. And he starts to, and he throws himself so much into the latter, and you're surprised that he does it, but you also realize that, like, No, this is an aspect of himself that he's been suppressing for so long that now he doesn't have to. And in fact, he can embrace it and he jumps all over it, only to find that that's even more complicated than he thought. And once he hits that complication, he pivots and goes over to the life that he's been choosing for so long, which is as a cop. And at the end of the film, it's actually quite tragic because neither one really work out for him because he's torn. And wonderfully structured. I think Roger Deakins shot it. I think it's a great looking movie as well. A solid cast of every single cast member has been in another David Mamet film, at least one. I feel like I don't know how much we talk about David Mamet outside of Spartan. I don't know how much we talk about David Mamet as a director, but man, like when it's working, and I think it often is, I think I like House of Games more than you.
Yeah. What's the last thing he directed? Cause I didn't like Red Belt.
I don't know. Neither of us like Red Belt. I don't know the last thing he actually directed.
We saw that together back when we used to go see movies together.
That's right. Back when we used to do anything together outside of podcast. I feel like he did some TV. I feel like he maybe made like a TV movie or something like that. But I feel like the last theatrical thing he did might've been Red Belt.
He made a 2013 TV movie. Oh, he directed the Phil Spector movie where Al Pacino played Phil Spector.
That's right. I assume he wrote that as well.
Well, let me click.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Find out. Yeah.
Okay.
As well. That's interesting.
That makes me more interested. I'd love to hear. Al Pacino doing Mamet dialogue.
The Unit. That was his TV show.
That's right. Yeah.
Red Belt is the last theatrical feature film he directed. That was 2008.
And that's unfortunate because that's something I would love for him to put behind him. but obviously State and Main, Spanish Prisoner, I feel like Oleana, I think because he adapted it from his own play and I think he was too close to it. And I think as a movie, it doesn't work super well.
Yeah, no.
All that is to say that listeners, if you're not that acquainted with David Mamet as a director, I would say Homicide's a great place to start, but it's almost all downhill from there. I think maybe even more so than Spartan. I think that's the pinnacle.
And I think we said that. Do you remember a million years ago, you and I were on the Criterion cast to discuss Homicide?
And House of Games, I believe.
Oh, and House of Games.
Yeah.
But do you remember when we recorded? It was 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, that's right.
Which is not still early for me. Not as now that I'm older, I get up earlier, but I was still in my 20s.
Back then, that was very early for me.
Yeah, and it was because, Moises was hosting, and he was in Austin, I guess. So it was, 10 a.m. his time was the only time he could do it. So, I remember I, picked up coffee and donuts and came to your house at 8 o'clock in the morning.
We really made a day of it. It worked out great.
Yeah, and then I probably went home and went back to sleep.
Yes.
All right. So, moving on, my final movie, the one I just watched last night, is the new film from director Bruce LaBruce. It's called Saint Narcisse.
Okay.
And it's, I will admit, the first Bruce LaBruce film that I've seen. I know him by reputation because he kind of made a big splash in 2010, I want to say, with a movie called L.A. Zombie.
Okay.
Which is, from what I understand, I haven't seen it. It's an introspective, art indie zombie film that about 40 minutes of the runtime is also hardcore explicit gay porn. So it made quite a splash when it came out.
Yeah.
And I think we ran a review of the DVD when it came out on DVD at battleshipretention.com.
You watch it?
No, I think Jack. Remember Jack? Jack Fleischer.
Oh, yeah.
I think he was the one who watched that.
He's he's like a chef now.
Oh, yeah. Right? I follow him on Instagram. He's a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
So I knew him by reputation, and I was excited to see his new film, Saint Narcisse, which I will say, maybe by Middle America standards is pretty risque, but by the standards of L.A. Zombie is tame. There's almost no explicit sex in it. There's a fair amount of male nudity, but, flaccid male nudity, for what it's worth.
I kind of hate that word, because I think probably because of the connotation, but it's just such a
But so it takes place sometime in the 1970s, starting in Montreal. There's a young man who lives with and takes care of his sickly grandmother. She dies. He then finds in her belongings letters from his mother, whom he was told died giving birth to him.
Oh, yeah.
And turns out, sounds like I had a mother this whole time. Hmm. And she lives in this town of Saint-Narcisse, Quebec. And so he goes up there, starts asking around, do you know a Beatrice Beauchamp? And the townspeople are like, oh, you mean the crazy old witch who lives in the woods? So then he like goes into the woods and finds his...
So many sentences you've been saying in the last few minutes don't end the way I think they're going to.
Yeah, so the movie has this... I could go on just telling the story because it gets there. I could continue to surprise you with plot developments, but it would get into spoiler territory. But the movie has a very now like shot on digital look in terms of how the images represent it, how the colors look and mm-hmm. the sharpness and things like that. But the style is clearly influenced by the kind of like cinema fantastique and like mid 60s schlock, like the same kind of stuff that Anna Biller's The Love Witch was referencing. But this isn't The Love Witch. It's a different movie. Obviously it's a different movie, but it's a different type of movie because The Love Witch is like very much homage and living in that space. And then has like, but yeah, it's like kind of the opposite. The Love Witch like tries to emulate that era of movies in every aesthetic way, and then weirdly has like cell phones and modern day cars because it takes place in the present day. Whereas this is the opposite. This is a movie that takes place in the early 70s, but clearly is shot with modern technology. But I really liked that sort of push and pull, where the way that push and pull, I almost mean literally, because there's a lot of zooms, you know, and there's a lot of like quick montage, and it has that sort of psychedelic feel, but it also has a very I think modern take on kink and sexual, the way that sexual expression might come from different kinds of repression, you know, that like the town is, there actually is a Saint-Narcisse, Quebec, but the Catholic undertones of that of that title are not an accident. It's also there's a monastery nearby, which in like, this is where I started to wonder if it was going to get into LA zombie territory, because the monastery is peopled by the hottest bunch of monks you've ever seen. They're all total beefcakes, these monks. But it doesn't quite get into that, but it does definitely get pretty kinky. And I was really into it, really fascinated by it. The main actor, whose name is something very French, or French Canadian, I guess, Felix something or other. Fuck, let me look up his name, because that's going to make me feel bad. Felix Antoine Duval is apparently, he's acted before, but he's also a stuntman, and I think that like plays into what Bruce LeBruce is casting him for, which is like physicality. I think like there's a lot of looking at his body. Obviously the camera looking at his body, sure, but there's also a whole lot of himself regarding his own body. Hmm. And I think having a very, not just physically fit, but physically agile and capable, performer, plays into that. I was really fascinated by the movie Saint-Narcisse. Okay. And yeah, if you're someone who's worried about explicit porn showing up in the movie, you can watch Saint-Narcisse. There's some kinky sex, but it's not literally explicit, like hardcore porn.
Well, I'll say this. If you are looking for like really explicit stuff, then my next film is probably not for you.
Okay.
It's Muppet Treasure Island. I recently started listening to the audiobook of Treasure Island. I've read the book a couple of times in my life. And it's just I've always thought it was a really solid book. And I was just interested to read it again. Then I remembered, I don't have time to read things, but I do have a commute. And so I started listening to it and thought, like, this has been adapted many times, and I'd be interested in watching some of those adaptations. And then I was like, well, the one I'm probably most familiar with is Muppet Treasure Island from 1996. And so it was on Disney Plus. So I was like, I'll throw that on. And it was something I liked at the time. And from an art direction standpoint, and actually from the music standpoint, I think is actually pretty solid. But what's interesting is, you know, when you think of the Muppets, obviously there's a fair amount of meta humor. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's an adult quality to the Muppets, and I don't mean adult in the sense of like inappropriate for like children or anything like that.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think of just like there's a sensibility, often a sense of humor that underscores all of that. And then, you know, obviously with Muppet Babies and then Muppet Christmas Carol, like they started really gearing more towards kids, but I feel like Muppet Christmas Carol especially is still pretty watchable. I feel like it balances things. You get to Muppet Treasure Island and the goofy Muppet stuff, it's hard to explain. It feels perfunctory. It feels like they're doing it because it's what's expected of them. Whereas the straightforward adaptation of Treasure Island, they seem much more interested in that. And taking and sanding some of the edges off, because it is a very violent story. And so, yeah, in a way, like, for example, like they have Kermit as Captain Smollett, and they don't really do anything with that. They just, it's just a straightforward, like the character's written in a very straightforward way, and they just have Kermit play him. They have Miss Piggy play Benjamina Gunn, like the castaway. And they do a little bit more with that, but for the most part, it just, it's hard to explain. Like, as a Muppet movie, I feel like it's really wanting. As a Treasure Island movie, not bad. But that's the thing, is because of the Muppet part, you can't really take the Treasure Island part 100% seriously. So I feel like it doesn't, unlike Muppet Christmas Carol, I feel like it doesn't balance the elements well. And I think it winds up being mostly a failure. I think it's not a bad looking movie, actually. And again, costumes and art direction, like it all works pretty well. But for the most part, it's, yeah, like it's something that I liked when it came out, because even at 14, I liked the meta aspect of the Muppets. But you watch it now, and it's like, oh, this could actually, it could have gone further in either direction, and it doesn't. And so it winds up being just like a bad mix of both.